Lecture 6, The First Nation in History.
Hi. I've got a question for you. Did you do your homework? Did you write your name in hieroglyphs? And did you write the names of three other famous people in hieroglyphs? It's fun, and you can practice it. Keep it going. It's a skill that you'll lose if you don't use it, so keep trying to do it. Now, remember in the first lecture I said that I was going to try to do this chronologically. I was trying to take things in order, but there would be some side trips. Well, the last two lectures have been the side trips. We've done Napoleon in Egypt and the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, and then a little bit about how the Rosetta Stone led to decipherment and something about Egyptian language. Well, I want to return to the chronological approach now. I want to go back to early Egypt. Now, remember we did prehistoric times, 700,000 years and 30 minutes. I want to come now to historic times, the very beginnings of writing in Egypt. And what we're going to discuss today is one document, the first historical document in the world, the Narmer Palette. And we're going to use this document to see a few things about Egyptian civilization. One is we'll see the political setup with a king as the divine ruler of Egypt. And we'll also see why having such a political setup will enable Egypt to do great things. But let me start with Egypt before it was a nation. Now, if you remember back to prehistory, we left Egypt around 3200 BC. A Nile Valley civilization, populated by little villages, maybe 150 people here, 150 people here, perhaps 2,000 in all. We're not sure exactly the numbers. And Egypt was divided into two kingdoms, Upper and Lower Egypt. And if you'll remember, Upper Egypt is beneath Lower Egypt because of the way the Nile flows. Well, right at the cusp of history in Egypt, written history, 3200 BC roughly, Upper Egypt seems to be ruled by a king and Lower Egypt by another king. And they had symbols, crowns. The kings had different crowns. It's interesting, isn't it, that somehow a hat becomes a symbol of authority. And it's remained that. Queen of England, policemen have special hats. Everybody's got special hats. And the kings of Egypt had special hats. In the south, it was the white crown, a tall white crown, kind of conical. In the north, it's the red crown. It's a shorter crown, has a little peak at the back, a little feather curling up in the front. So you have the tall white crown of the south and the red crown of the north. Tell you something really interesting about the crowns, and this is my theory, certainly may be wrong, but you shouldn't take it as fact. The fact is that no crown has ever been found. We do not have the crown of any king of Egypt. For 3,000 years, the pharaohs wore the red and the white crown. None has ever been found. Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered intact. Everything he packed in there for the next world was there. No crown. No crown. My theory, and this is the part that really may be wrong, I'll just present it, is that I don't think there was more than one crown in existence at any one time. I think it was like, it was a magical thing. The crowns were believed to have actual magical powers. And I think it was the one thing that when a pharaoh died, he couldn't take with him to the next world. His successor got the crown. So I think there was probably only one red crown and one white crown in existence at any one time. And that's why it wasn't found in Tutankhamun's tomb. But that's just a theory. But the important thing is that very early on in Egyptian history, these crowns were the symbol of power. Now, there was probably some communication between Upper and Lower Egypt, but it was limited. Travel wasn't easy, remember, in ancient Egypt. You know, you had the Nile. That was a good way to go long distances, but the common man certainly couldn't afford a boat. And the only other way you went anyplace in Egypt was donkey. It was the donkey for the short haul and boats for the long haul. So communication was probably limited. But then, around, the best guess is 3150 BC, right? 3150 BC, Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt is unified. It becomes one country, right? One country. And how is it unified? Apparently, by a king from the south conquering in the north. And that king's name is Narmer. And we have an object called the Narmer Palette, which is what I call the first historical document in the world. It tells of the unification of Egypt. And what I want to do today is tell you about the Narmer Palette and how it tells the story of the unification of Egypt. Now first, about the palette itself. It's a palette that's about 2 feet high. And it's made of slate, but isn't an ordinary slate palette. Now, as you remember, the ordinary Egyptians used palettes for grinding their cosmetics. They would take a little bit, for example, of carbon, charcoal from a fire, mix it with fat, and grind it on the palette, and that became eye makeup. It's the first cosmetics in the world. And they would put it under their eye. And also, you know, in desert countries, it helps absorb the glare. It's not just decorative. That's why when you look at football players, they're wearing basically eye makeup under their eyes, black, to absorb the glare so it doesn't go into your eye. So this is not one of those palettes, though. This is a highly decorated, carved palette. It's what we call a ceremonial palette. It was probably never used in a house. It's too big, it's too fancy, it's too elaborate. It was probably a temple object. It may have even been used to grind the cosmetics for a statue of the gods. See, every temple, in the back of the temple, had an area called the Holy of Holies, a shrine where only the priests could go. And in that Holy of Holies was a bronze statue of the god, whoever was the god of that temple. So if it was Amun, it would be a statue of Amun. And the priests, every morning, would throw open the doors and anoint the statue with oils, cosmetics, give it an offering of foods, and then close the doors. This may have been a palette that was used to anoint the gods. It's really big, beautiful, and important. But it tells a story, and that's why I say it's the first historical document in the world. Now, the palette does a few things for us. First, it's the beginnings of language. This is where we get our first real hieroglyphs telling a story. Another thing is it sets a kind of artistic convention, artistic style, that is going to last for 3,000 years. This is where we're going to see the king as a symbol of Egypt. See, the king is really the way you said Egypt. He was the icon. Egypt meant the pharaoh. He was that central. The pharaoh's role was to keep divine order in the world. See, the Egyptians had this strong concept of divine order, that there was a certain order, and Egypt was on top of that order. And the king's job was to make the right offerings to the gods, make sure that the gods were pleased and divine order would stay. So the king is the symbol of Egypt. Now, in addition, not only is he the symbol of Egypt, he's presented in what we call hierarchical proportion. The king is bigger than everybody. When you look on a temple wall, everybody's not the same size. The king is about 4 or 5 times the size of a commoner. And he's almost the same size as the gods, because he is a god on earth. He is the god Horus on earth. So on this Narmer palette, we see a king who is larger than everybody else, and he is the symbol of Egypt. Now, let me tell you what is on this palette. On one side of the palette, and it's carved on both sides, on one side of the palette, we see a king. He's got this tall white crown, so we know he's from the south. He's wearing the white crown. And he is in a pose that will be repeated for 3,000 years of Egyptian history. It's called smiting. He's about to kill his enemy. He has his arm raised, and in his arm, he's got a mace. Now, a mace is a weapon. It's basically a rock on a stick. It's a stick that can be held in the hand with a big rock on the end of it, and you smash your enemy's skull with it. And Narmer is about to smite. He's got his hand raised. And in his other hand, he is holding an enemy. It's a man with a beard. And he's got him by the hair. This is a traditional pose that you're going to see for 3,000 years. Ramses the Great, 1,000 years later, is going to show the same thing. He's got the enemies by the hair, and he's about to smite him with a mace. So Narmer is a king from the south about to smite the enemy. Now, who is this enemy? Well, there are some hieroglyphs in the background that give you a clue. Behind the enemy, we see swampy plants We see a kind of marsh, and we see some plants coming out. That might suggest this enemy is the ruler of the delta area. Now, the delta, of course, is a marshy, swampy area in the north of Egypt. And you know why it's called the delta? That's because of the Greeks. When the Greeks came into Egypt, the swampy, marshy area was a triangle shaped like the Greek letter delta. So they called it a delta. It didn't have anything to do with swamp or marsh. It was just triangular, and now we've picked that up. So this person who was about to be killed by Narmer is perhaps the ruler of the delta. And when you look at the palette, there's some brutal things there. One of the things is the enemy, this poor guy from the delta, who was about to be killed by Narmer, has a ring placed through his nose. And the ring is attached to a string, which is held by a falcon. Now, the falcon is the symbol of the pharaoh. So the pharaoh has the enemy through the nose. Right? This poor guy is about to be dispatched by the king of Egypt. Now, quite interesting, behind the king is some little tiny guy. He's about one-fifth the size of Narmer. And you have to look really close when you're looking at the Narmer palette, which is in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. You have to look really close. But he's carrying sandals. Carrying a pair of sandals. He is the sandal bearer to the king. Carries the king's sandals. Now, I don't think it means that the king really wanted to change his shoes very often. But this is an official title. He is an important official. He's not just a toady who's bringing stuff, a gopher. No. This guy is like maybe the viceroy of Egypt. And he's behind the king. But he's only about one-fifth the size. Now, how do we know this is Narmer? How do we know his name? At the top, very top of the palette, is a rectangle. Now, that rectangle is called in Egyptian a serech. It's a rectangle that represents the palace. This is where the king lived. And inside that little rectangle are two hieroglyphs, a chisel and a fish. Right? A chisel and a fish. Those are the hieroglyphs for Nar and Mer. Right? Chisel is Mer, fish is Nar. And that's how we know his name. Who's in the palace? Who's in the rectangle? Narmer. This is the first name we have of a king of Egypt. Narmer is almost certainly the first king of Egypt. And he writes his name in this palace facade, right? A serach. So we've got Narmer, the beginnings of hieroglyphs, and we've got him smiting the enemy from the delta. And if you look at the bottom of the palette, that side, you'll see enemies who are kind of almost look like they're swimming. They've probably been killed, maybe, or they're trying to flee, something like that. They look just like the guy who's got this nose ring through him, you know, this poor guy. But Narmer is about to conquer these guys. Now, an important thing to notice also on the palette, if you stare at it in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, is that the palette has everybody standing on registers. There's like a line beneath the feet. This is another artistic tradition. You don't just let them float around. It's kind of too confusing. It would look a little disjointed. So registration, as we call it, having the people always stand on something is a tradition. Even if you look at hieroglyphs, whenever you look at hieroglyphs in ancient Egypt, the birds are always standing on something. They're not just kind of floating around. So this is only one side of the palette, right? Only one side. But it's telling a big story. If you look very closely at Narmer, you'll see something really neat. He's wearing a belt. He's got a kind of girdle around him, you know? And that's some sort of official garment. He is wearing some official garment. And if you look very closely at the little figure, this guy is kind of hunched over, and he's holding his shoulder. Now, why is he holding his shoulder? He's wearing a garment that doesn't fit him right. He's wearing a leopard skin. The leopard skin is the sign of a high priest. So he's also the vizier of Egypt, probably, and a high priest. And for another 3,000 years, this leopard skin is going to be the sign of the high priest. So think about it. You know, a leopard skin is not a form-fitting garment. He's got to hold it. He's hunched over. It's not very comfortable, but this is something that's going to be a tradition. And there's one other thing if you look at this little guy. He's got a little necklace on. And what that necklace is probably his seal of authority. It's a cylinder seal that was rolled out in clay to stamp his name when he had to do official things for the king. So we've got Narmer, and he's already got an official behind him. And he's conquering this delta, this poor delta guy. But that's only one side of the palette. On the other side, we have the conclusion of the story. We've got what happens. Now, what we have at the end, on the other side, is King Narmer, But he's not wearing the white crown anymore. He's wearing the red crown, the short red crown. He has conquered the north and now is the king of Upper and Lower Egypt. It's the unification of Egypt. And from Namur on, the pharaoh will wear what we call the double crown. He will wear a crown which is both a composite of both the red and the white. It'll be the tall white, and in front of it will be the short red one. That is the sign that the king is the king of both Upper and Lower Egypt. So Namur is the first uniter of Egypt, and Egypt becomes the first nation in history. That is a first. Now, but that's not all the palette tells us. If you look beneath or near Namur, there is a procession going on. There are little people, and they're holding poles, and on top of the poles are little symbols of their areas where they come from. They're marching in procession, and they are marching towards people who are lying down, have their hands tied behind their backs, and their heads have been cut off. These are the vanquished. Namur has won, and he's cut off the heads of the enemy. And we've got our little vizier, the little guy, following behind. Now, beneath Namur, though, are two fantastic animals. They don't exist in real life. They look kind of like panthers or leopards with very long legs, very long necks, like a giraffe. And the necks are intertwined. They're somehow uniting these two panthers. And I think that may be the symbol of the unification of Egypt. The intertwined necks is Upper and Lower Egypt being joined together. And beneath them is a fortress, a walled city of some sort. Big crenellations on the top, you know, the bumps that archers like stay behind. And that wall is being broken down by a bull. The bull will also become a symbol of Namur. Namur has come to the delta, a fortified city, broken down the walls, killed the king of the north, taken the enemies, and he is now in control. So Namur becomes the first pharaoh of the first dynasty. He is sometimes also called Menes, by the way. The general theory is that Namur and Menes, there are different kings lists, are the same one. They are each the first king of the first dynasty. Now, why is the Namur palette so important? Let me tell you one curious thing about it, that it's, again, my personal theory, and it's kind of strange, but I think it might be right. If you look very closely, at the hieroglyphs and the images that are drawn on the Namur palette, and I've spent hours standing in the Egyptian Museum looking at it. I've looked at enlarged photos of it. I think you also will be convinced, as I am, that the Namur palette was carved by two different people. One side is carved by one person, and one side is carved by the other. Now, why do I say that? If you look, for example, at the serechs, those rectangles that represent the palace, you'll see they have different numbers of doors in them. They're totally different. The same artist would never do that. And the same is true for other elements of the palette. If you look at the figures, they're carved completely differently. Now, I don't know what it means. I'm not sure. But I'll give you just one suggestion that, again, is theory, and I emphasize this theory, but it kind of shakes the established interpretation of the Namur palette. What I wonder is this. If the palette is indeed carved by two different people, and I'm quite sure it is, why? It's a small object. Why did two different people do it? Now, it could be something trivial. It could indeed be, say, the artist was sick. He said, Harry, you take over. Somebody else did it. Could be. But it also could be that some time passed between the carving of the first side and the carving of the second side. And that could mean that we may be reading the palette wrong. How do we know to read the side that I said is the first side first? Maybe we should read it the other way and we get a different story. It's just a possibility. I suggest it for another reason. I have another reason why I think we might be reading it backwards. Which side would you consider the first side, the most important? I would consider the one that has the round depression of the intertwined necks, because that's where you'd grind your cosmetics. That's where the cosmetics will ground. And certainly that would be the first side, the most important. So there's just a slight chance that this first historical document in the world may be being read backwards. But I just throw that out as a suggestion. It's a kind of partly baked idea. But I just wanted to mention that at least you know that the Namur palette was carved by two different people. And that I think everybody would agree with. Now, why is this so important? Well, it's not just that it's the first document in history. It's that it's going to set up Egypt in such a way that Egypt can rule the entire Near East. Because now Egypt has a single king who is a god on earth. Remember, that poor little guy from the Delta with a ring in his nose is being held by a falcon. The pharaoh was Horus on earth. Remember, Horus was the son of Osiris who was killed. He's the avenger. He's the one who set it right, who defeats his evil uncle Seth. So the pharaoh, as Horus, is a god on earth. Now, other nations in the Middle East, ancient nations, had kings. But the king was not a god. Only Egypt had a god. And there are real virtues to this. So we have Egypt unified under a god king. Now, why is that great? I'll tell you why. If you have a completely powerful ruler, you can do almost anything. You know, Plato said it. Plato wrote a book called The Republic. And in The Republic, Plato talks about what's the ideal form of government. What's the best way to rule a nation? And Plato came up with, you should have a philosopher king ruling. Now, he was a philosopher, of course, so he would want a philosopher ruling. But there was a rationale behind it. Plato said, you want a philosopher because you want a society that's just, that's fair. And justice, who better to determine that than a philosopher? But you want him also to be a king because you want him to have absolute power. You don't want him to get stuck in bureaucratic red tape. You want him to know what's right and then do it. No ifs, ands, or buts. So Plato said, the best government is a philosopher king. Thomas Hobbes, the political philosopher, said much later that the ideal form of government is a monarch, a king. And he, of course, was English under a king. But the idea was that without a ruler with real absolute power, we'd live in a state of jungle. We'd be killing each other. So what we do, he said, is we give up our rights so that we're safe. We have a monarch who will rule us and tell us what to do. So this notion that the best government is an absolute ruler may really come out of Egypt. Now, with a king who is a god, the absolute ruler, you can do great things. And let me tell you about what Egypt could do because they had a Narmer, somebody unifying Egypt, and they'd have it for 3,000 years. First, you can build a standing army. You can say, we need an army. You, let's go. And that's it. You've got a god king, you don't discuss it. With a standing army, you can march out, conquer other lands. And by the way, there is a pottery fragment with Narmer's name on it, all the way in the Sinai, near Palestine, actually. That may mean that Narmer took the army outside of Egypt. Who knows? It's just a fragment, doesn't mean that much. But it suggests we've got kind of an expansionist viewpoint now. You can have an army. But more important than an army, much more important, you can marshal the resources of a country by fiat. You say it and it's done. And you can get great things done. And let me say exactly what I mean by that. Irrigation ditches. Now, if you remember, Herodotus, our Greek tourist, said that Egypt is the gift of the Nile. What he meant was that the rich topsoil is deposited during inundation. Now, let me describe inundation for you as the Egyptians saw it. First, understand that inundation, when the Nile rose and overflowed its banks, was not viewed as a natural phenomenon. The Egyptians did not know the source of the Nile. As a matter of fact, we didn't know the source of the Nile until the middle of the 19th century. That's why you had guys like Burton and Speke exploring and Bruce going in search of the source of the Nile. Now, the main cause of inundation is the monsoon season in Ethiopia. The waters torrent down, pour into the Nile, and as the Nile flows northward, you get two Niles joining at Khartoum, the white and the blue Nile. Now, think about what the Egyptians saw during inundation. First, the Nile turned red. Now, it turned red because it was carrying with it the topsoil, the rich red soil, from Ethiopia, northward. So first it turns red. Then it turns green. That's the slower-moving vegetation coming from the south. The topsoil moves quickly. It's small. It's suspended in the water. The vegetation is floating on top. Turns green. Then it rises 30 feet. It must have been a magical event. And it happened every year, around July, like clockwork. Remarkable. They didn't know the source. They thought it was the gods around the area of Aswan in the south of Egypt, opening doors in caverns underneath the Nile that caused it to overflow the banks. But now, as it deposits the rich topsoil, this enables Egypt to grow the crops. But how can you increase the yield? How can you really make it sort of maximum? This is where Narmer, this is where a strong king comes in. He can marshal the entire forces of Egypt for work projects that are to the benefit of all the Egyptians. And you know what that is? Irrigation ditches. What Egypt learned to do was to coax the Nile inward, to give you as much topsoil as possible inward, and to keep the Nile waters inward. So they dug irrigation ditches. This was a major work project, which involved all the farmers. Now remember, of course, farmers. I mean, farming and farmers is what Egypt was about. It was an agrarian society. 90% were farmers. So you take all the farmers, and you say, it's time to get ready. The inundation is coming. The priest astronomers knew when it was coming. And you start digging the irrigation ditches. So that when the floods come, and it overflows the banks, it'll bring the water inland, and you've got fields and fields to irrigate. That's what you can do if you have a powerful centralized government. So Egypt is the first nation in history with a powerful centralized government. You know, Egypt will have times when the government collapses, when horrible things happen. We call them intermediate periods. We don't even know. They're dark ages. But they will always go back to a pharaoh, a god king as the ruler. Because that was the government they knew that worked. That's what they thought was part of divine order. Divine order involved centralized government with a pharaoh telling everyone what to do. That's partly why the Narmer Palette is so important. Now, one other thing. If you can get people together for working for the public good, what else can you do besides irrigation ditches? Right? Now, the answer is build pyramids. You see, the skills, there is a reason why it's Egypt that builds pyramids and not the other countries. You had a strong centralized government with a tradition of marshaling manpower. And remember, the Egyptians did not use beasts of burden very well. When you hauled big blocks of stone, it was with people. Not animals. The only use they really used animals for beasts of burden was for plowing. That's the first use of domesticated animals. But when it came to big blocks moving stones, we have pictures of them moving huge statues. And it's lots of guys hauling on ropes that are doing it. So if you don't have beasts of burden, it's manpower that you need. And this strong centralized government is going to do it for you. You can say, okay, we're going to do this. So I think that what made Egypt capable of building pyramids is really two things. One is they had this strong centralized government with a king at the head, but they also had this tradition of public work projects where they were told to do things for the good, for the benefit of all. And once they could do that, it was a short hop to the building of the pyramids of Egypt. It would take just a few hundred years from Narmer's conquest of ancient Egypt, from unifying it, coming from the south, defeating the king of the north, and wearing a double crown, in a few hundred years, Egypt would be building the Great Pyramid of Egypt. But that's a story for next time. So I'll see you next time. Thank you.